Welcome to the Security Analysis Podcast. This podcast explores investment strategies, economics, personal finance, and stock analysis. It features real conversations and analysis to inform, educate, and entertain. Note that nothing in this podcast is investment advice, and it is for entertainment and discussion purposes only. Do your own due diligence before making any investment. Now, on to the show.
Today, I'm speaking with HML Compounder. He's a good follow on Twitter. Like myself, he's a DIY investor posting about his personal portfolio and connecting with other investors online. HML refers to high minus low, or the difference between returns and value stocks and growth stocks, as defined by FAMA in French. So welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, BSG. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah, excited to chat with you. So how'd you first get interested in investing?
I actually can't remember the exact catalyst, but I came out of college, I studied aerospace engineering and started my career at Elon Musk SpaceX, and the culture there was not very 401k centric. You know, they didn't have a 401k match. Everyone was just kind of all in on the crazy growth of the SpaceX stock machine. So
yeah, Elon doesn't strike me as a Jack Bogle kind of
guy. Well, funny enough, you know, I got into the SpaceX equity thing and, you know, was riding that train for a while. And I don't know what sparked this, but, you know, when I was trying to kind of figure out how does personal finance work out, I actually did start with the Bogleheads Forum, believe it or not. And, you know, very quickly kind of, you know, was drawn to it. The whole, you know, don't look for the needle in the haystack, just buy the haystack kind of, you know, ideology. And yeah, I mean, it seemed really compelling to me, and I kind of just plowed right into that forum. I don't know if you spent much time on the Boglehead forum, but awesome community for someone just starting out. And, you know, there's a small contingent there that, you know, was into this small cap value thing. And I was like, okay, what's this all about? Oh, you know, it's done better historically. You know, it's kind of contrarian. It seems interesting. And initially, I'll admit, I probably didn't have an incredible understanding for mechanics or kind of how it would work. But I was like, oh, there's a bunch of people who put 20% of their portfolio into small cap value and, you know, diversify a little bit, maybe get some outperformance. Seems kind of interesting, but it just kind of fueled this obsession. And over the years on that forum, I went from just being the noob that was kind of absorbing all this information to being what I would consider someone relatively competent and was kind of helping other new people coming in. But yeah, the whole value story just really grew, you know, that I think the engineer in me likes kind of the risk-based story, can't be arbitraged, but over the years, it's definitely been the behavioral side that I find most compelling. And maybe it was because I started out in kind of a growth bubble type of market. So this was like maybe 2015, 2016, when I kind of got a little bit heavier investing and started researching all this. And then my time at SpaceX, every quarter, you know, there'd be a buyback or something. And everyone was just saying, oh man, the stock price is going to go up so much when we meet this milestone. And I'm just thinking, like, that's not how it works. It's all priced in, you know, like just because this thing is coming up in the future and everyone thinks it's going to happen and it happens doesn't mean the price is going to go up. Of course, hindsight 2020, they were all right. The stock did, you know, continue to go up. But as you know, that's not always how it works. And Elon has kind of been an anomaly, both in public and private markets. But yeah, it's just, I always like to say, you know, stocks outperform if the business outperforms expectations, not if it outperforms other businesses. And I feel like that's something that most of the masses just really don't understand or don't really take to heart.
Yeah, that's definitely not how a lot of this stuff works. It's something most people have to learn the hard way through experience.
Absolutely.
So as an engineer, how has that influenced your process? So I've interviewed a lot of DIY investors on this podcast, and so many of them are engineers. And I think fascinating how they seem to be attracted to the DIY investing process. How has it influenced your process?
Yeah, I mean, like most DIY investors, I love playing with backtests. I love playing with the data. Probably to a fault, you know, as we talk about kind of my journey, I started out with value, but there's been other areas that I've been interested in. Tinkering has definitely been a common theme. And I think that, you know, being an engineer and finding some new data and being like, oh, look at the improvement to my Sharpe ratio that's generated, or, you know, look at the CAGR increase, or look at the drawdown benefit, can be a bit problematic. But at the end of the day, the numbers do matter. And I think, you know, being an engineer definitely gives me a bit of an advantage in kind of understanding them. But you do have to be careful, especially if you're using back tests with non-live data or other assumptions that aren't accounted for. So yeah, I think being an engineer is kind of a blessing and a curse. I always like the saying, I think Wes Gray uses it, that investing is more art than science. And I think it's important to keep that in mind, especially for a lot of the strategies that I'm into. I really do believe they're mostly behaviorally driven. It's kind of the way that I've leaned over the years. And, you know, obviously modeling human behavior can be extremely difficult. But to the same token, I kind of think that there is some consistency there. One of my favorite Jim O'Shaughnessy quotes that is kind of the foundation of my investment approach is that arbitraging human nature is the last sustainable edge. So there's so much brain power out there. There's so much computing power. Markets are so competitive. But at the end of the day, human nature kind of wins out. And personally, I think that is kind of what gives me my edge. I'm an engineer. I consider myself a sharp person, but I'm definitely not by any means the smartest participant in the market. But if I can have just a little bit more conviction, if I can talk myself out of selling if something isn't working and holding strong, I think that that can actually give me just enough edge to outperform a little bit without necessarily being the smartest guy in the room.
I gotcha. Yeah. And I mean, you definitely see that in markets when you see how volatile things are, that those animal spirits are alive and well, that humans are definitely responding to prices and they're overreacting to things. And it's not just purely a group of rational people.
Absolutely. And I mean, I know you know this well, but I personally think that the investment case for value, and especially you could say value in international markets, which are kind of double unloved for being value and, you know, non-US, is pretty compelling today. And of course, it's been compelling for the last 4 or 5 years. So, you know, it's not always like it works right away. But I do definitely think that humans have gone a little bit crazy in some areas of the market. And, you know, they still seem to think that those are the areas that are going to be working the best over the next 5, 10 years. And personally, I'm betting the other direction.
Gotcha. So it sounds like that you think that the value factor is more behavioral. So I've heard there's different theories about what drives the value factor. So some people say it's risk. Some people say that it's just systematically buying things below intrinsic value. Where do you stand on that? As it sounds like you're mostly in the behavioral side.
Yeah, I would probably say I'm in the 2/3 behavioral, kind of 1/3 risk-based. It's always nice to have something be risk-based. The odds that it's going to get arbitraged away are meaningfully lower. But kind of the more time I spend just kind of watching the market, talking to other friends and other investors and seeing the kind of just the crazy things that are going on out there, the more compelled I believe that there really is some behavioral things going on there. I think humans are just naturally prone to over extrapolating in both directions. If something's been doing really well, they expect it to continue. If something's been doing really poorly, they expect it to continue. And you can see that in the data with earnings, right? Like earnings projections for growth tend to be much higher than the, you know, future realized earnings. And for value, they tend to be higher than the current expectation. And the growth earnings do end up being better than the value earnings, but just not to the same extent that the market had originally priced in. And, you know, that's a big driver of the premium, I believe. And you get a combo of just higher earnings yield if a stock remains in value, but it's also, you know, a nice trading strategy as well, where you get the migration where, you know, smaller, cheaper stocks will become larger, more expensive stocks. You get a nice little premium there. Maybe they move out of your screen, you sell them for a profit and buy some growth stock that has fallen and become a value stock. And yeah, I definitely appreciate in that component of it as well. It's like a very nice way to have a forced buy low, sell high trading strategy. And, you know, with all the wonderful ETFs out there, it's actually quite tax efficient and, you know, pretty low trading costs to have a strategy that has pretty meaningful turnover. So
do you think that value factor has been arbitraged away in any way? Do you think that maybe the returns that we've seen in the past will be lower and, you know, lower than they have been? Like, where do you stand on that issue?
I always anticipate a smaller premium moving forward. I mean, I think it's just best to have realistic expectations. Markets are definitely more efficient now. You know, obviously, after the 1993 Fama French publication of value, you would expect to have some reduction in the premium. But the data just doesn't seem to suggest that it's been arbitraged away. Obviously, the value factor in the U.S. has not had as strong of a premium, or over, you know, depending on the period you're measuring it, slightly negative. But the value spread has also grown astronomically. And, you know, people will say, oh, this is just, you know, financials and energies, or this is tech. But AQR had a great piece that came out like 2020, 2021. I think it's like the death of systematic value or something along those lines. And they basically showed the value spread just sliced every possible way you could imagine. And, you know, sector neutral, excluding mega caps, excluding most expensive stocks. And no matter how you sliced it, no matter what value metric you used, it's just a straight line up. It's unbelievable how much the value spread is blown out. And they also looked at a bunch of fundamentals to show that the spread between growth and value stocks, you know, outside of price, really hasn't changed all that much, or in some of the cases actually was kind of leaning towards value. And that to me would indicate this is a behavioral thing and that potentially this is actually a tailwind for value moving forward. Furthermore, internationally, the value premium has actually been pretty good. Over the last 2 to 3 years, you know, in emerging markets and developed ex-US markets, there's been a pretty strong, very strong in some cases, outperformance for value and small value funds relative to their market beta counterparts. So I think that naturally the U.S. is the market that most U.S. investors focus on, and value hasn't done quite as well there, although it has outperformed meaningfully in the last 3 years. So I think it's a lot easier to say that value's been arbitraged away or value's dead. But when I look at the big picture, I think it's actually worked pretty well even in recent years. And I think the future is extremely bright as well.
Gotcha. And what do you think has driven that gulf in performance between large cap growth and small value in the U.S.?
I mean, it's hard to say. Some of these things are just going to be cyclical in nature. You know, I was just looking at Yardini has these, you know, really awesome plots of the forward PE of the S&P 500 large cap, 400 mid cap, and 600 small caps over the last, I don't know, 15, 20 years, something like that. And I was pretty shocked at how cheap the S&P 500 was for the first few years of the 2010s. I want to say it was somewhere in a PE around 12. And the small and mid caps were actually priced 17, 18 kind of realm, a bit closer to where large caps are today. And over that decade, you just saw the large caps get more expensive and the small caps get cheaper. So I think markets just naturally kind of have an ebb and flow coming out of the tech crash of 2000. People were kind of scared out of these markets. And then especially with, you know, the financial crisis to kind of cap it off, things just naturally got a bit cheaper than they probably deserved to be. And similarly, the small caps that did so well in the early 2000s, probably got a little bit too expensive. So I think markets just naturally have this kind of cyclical nature, and it's easy to look back and say, oh man, large caps have just dominated the last decade. But when you look at the difference in valuations, I think that really does explain a lot, and see the same thing in other markets, say emerging markets or China in particular, you know, incredibly cheap in 2000, incredibly expensive in 2007, 2008, after incredible outperformance. The last 10, 15 years, it's been flat in China, for example. But that's pretty likely when you're coming off of, you know, the nosebleed PEs that it started that period at. So I think markets are going to cycle, and I think value is a good way to systematically kind of exploit that, the forced buy low, sell high nature of it.
Yeah, gotcha. And I agree with what you said about how the S&P 500 was pretty cheap back in the day, back in 2010. Jake Taylor, he actually wrote an interesting article about the spread between value and growth, and like value was historically expensive in the late 2000s after the run it had, and growth was systematically cheap. And you kind of get that from like just the way the vibes from people back then. Like if you go back to the late 2000s, it was almost like if you were a growth investor, it was a joke. You were a degenerate. Like, why are you doing? Like now that's completely, and you know, real investors did value investing. And now that's like completely shifted. It's just funny how that goes.
It is. I wish I could still find the link, but I actually had found an old post. I think it was the Boglehead Forum, but maybe it had a different name, kind of the earlier inception, but it was from like circa 2005, 2006. And it was a whole thread of people saying, is growth investing dead? Is this the end? And I just thought it was so funny because that's all you see now, you know, or it's all you saw in recent years on all these various forums, Twitter, whatnot, with regards to value. So yeah, I think, you know, markets are going to ebb and flow. And, you know, I think it's difficult for most people to stick with a strategy long enough to really reap that small benefit. You know, if you're expecting value to win long-term by, say, 1% to 2% in a long-only portfolio, there's going to be years where the difference is much larger than that in both directions. And if you don't hold on, you know, you're just going to end up selling low, and you're going to underperform by 1% to 2%, if not much more. So it really takes a lot of conviction. It's a low sharp strategy, and that's kind of why I think it'll persist longer. You know, if it had a sharp of 1.5, I wouldn't expect it to stick around very long. But you know, because it's so hard to hold and kind of the time spans that make it work are so long sometimes, I think it's got a fighting chance of sticking around.
Yeah, I agree with you. And so you're a believer in the value factor. How do you express that? Like, what are the specific ETFs you use? Do you go buy individual stocks at all? How do you express that view?
Yeah, so I'm all in ETFs for the value exposure. I've kind of dabbled around with various products, but currently I'm using Avantis's small cap value and their EM value fund. So that's AVUV for US, AVDV for developed small cap value, and AVES for EM value. And then I also complement that with the Alpha Architect value funds, QVAL and IVAL. Yeah, so the Avantis funds, I mean, they're extremely flexible. You know, they're not index-based, so they can trade daily, which I think helps you keep a bit more, you know, consistent factor exposure. You're not kind of decaying between your quarterly rebalances. They do use price-to-book as their valuation metric, but they combine it with a cash-based profitability. And if you compare them to something like, you know, say a dimensional fund, which is, you know, a common one, you'll see, honestly, the returns are quite similar. But when you look at the characteristics, you'll see a bit more expensive on price to book for Avantis, but much cheaper on like earnings and cash flow based metrics, which as someone who's very heavily into value, I appreciate having a bit more of that kind of profitability tilt, you know, just to kind of keep things balanced. Obviously, Fahm and French really like the price to book, you know, metric. And personally, I think it has more to do with the low turnover. But for me, using an earnings based metric is just a bit more intuitive. Obviously, at the end of the day, earnings are what matters. Book is kind of a proxy. So that's kind of been the direction I've gone in a small cap arena. And then, yeah, the Alpha Architect funds, you know, as I know, you know, they use the EV/EBIT ratio, you know, obviously very earnings cash flow driven by that, no book exposure at all. And yeah, those funds, they're highly concentrated, 50 stocks, equal weight, pull from a universe of the 1500 largest stocks. So you do get some small and mid cap and occasionally some large cap when it's cheaper, but they definitely skew larger than the Avantis small cap value funds. But they don't do that while giving up the kind of value exposure that you would typically give up if you were to use a more diversified large cap value fund. So I find combining the Avantis small cap value, which is more diversified, deeper into small caps, with the concentrated kind of more mid-large cap Alpha Architect, I get exposure across all the different cap sizes, but without sacrificing that value tilt. And, you know, obviously their approaches to value are a bit different. The sector constraints are quite different. Alpha Architect, for example, doesn't have any financials. Financials are the largest sector in, you know, Avantis small cap value for the U.S. fund. So kind of keeps me diversified, but still what I would consider a very strong tilt towards value.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I do like the Avantis funds as well. I recently started allocating to them in my own portfolio. And they do come from that DFA lineage. Like all the people in there, I think, are former DFA people. I'd like to get some of them on the podcast and actually talk to them about it. But yeah, I agree. Those funds are excellent. And they're pretty low fee too. The expense ratios aren't bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's pretty mind-blowing. You know, you can literally get a daily traded, you know, systematic portfolio with all this incredible pedigree of, you know, PhDs, kind of PhD-driven, you know, evidence-based investing for 25 basis points for AVUV. But Alpha Architect has recently dropped their fees on their U.S. funds to 29 and 39 on their international funds. So they're kind of getting into that arena, which is pretty awesome as well. And, you know, they also recently implemented monthly rebalancing, you know, to kind of keep the factor load more consistent. So yeah, it's a very competitive space. It's kind of unbelievable that these places are able to make a profit, but great for us.
Yeah, QVAL is very interesting. And I agree that they've been able to really reduce their fees as they've increased the AUM of that fund. So yeah, it's pretty impressive. So I assume that you was reading Quantitative Value a big influence on you?
Absolutely, yeah. So I always like to joke that I typically use a Kindle when I'm doing reading, and I own a hardback cover version of Quantitative Value and Quantitative Momentum, the book that Wes wrote on and Jack wrote on Momentum.
Yeah,
I own that on the Kindle. So Value is my true love, and I've, you know, it deserved a book on the bookshelf. But I appreciate both the books, and actually the most recent addition to my portfolio has been a small allocation to cross-sectional, you know, long-only Momentum through the Alpha Architect Fund. So I've become a bit of a believer in some diversification there.
Yeah, I do the same thing with books. So I'll buy the, I read pretty much everything on Kindle, but if I really love the book, I'll get the hardcover version because I'm like, this one deserves the real deal on my bookshelf. Okay, so you mentioned Momentum. So you also allocate to Momentum. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, so Momentum was actually something that for a long time I was kind of apprehensive about You know, the nice thing about value that I find compelling behaviorally is, all right, you've got a big drawdown, your value names, you know, typically the price is going to drop more than the fundamentals, you know, obviously situationally dependent, but, you know, often value will get even cheaper, you know, as you're going into a crash. And it's very easy for me to say, all right, I need to plow some more money in, like, you know, look at how cheap this fund is getting. This is going to have a great rebound. It's a loaded spring. Momentum, on the other hand, you're crashing, and what you're holding, if it's crashing more than the market, you're going to sell it low. You're going to, you know, be forced to sell it, maybe buy some utility or something that hasn't gone down as much. Behaviorally, that was kind of difficult for me to get on board with. But I want to say it was kind of late 2021, I started to look more seriously at managed futures, or, you know, systematic long short trend following on many asset classes, bonds, commodities, currencies, equities. And I started to gain an appreciation for the diversification benefit of that, especially once I got a better grasp for the capital efficiency of these strategies. So there are ways that you can overlay a managed futures trend portfolio top of an equity portfolio for very reasonable borrowing costs, very meaningful leverage, and kind of slowly gained conviction in adding this managed futures overlay as a form of diversification. And I found, as I got comfortable with its forced nature of obviously selling something when it goes down and holding it when it's going up, I kind of found that the cross-sectional, you know, long-only equity momentum started to make a little bit more sense to me. At the end of the day, value is still my, like, one true love. It's the premium I see the most that makes the most sense to me. You know, I'm the most convicted that it will have an outperformance over the market. Equity momentum, I kind of look at it as, you know, historically it's worked very well, but the one thing that I'm certain of is that it's going to have a very low correlation to value. I have high confidence that that isn't going to go away. So even if the equity holdings that I have just match the market performance standalone, you know, net of fees, that for me would still be worthwhile to hold just for the diversification benefit, you know, to offset some underperformance periods for value.
Gotcha. And how do you express that view? Like, what are some of the products that you use?
Yeah. So on the equity side, I use QMOM and IMOM, the Alpha Architects, you know, concentrated 50 stock momentum funds, some other interesting products out there, but theirs is by far the most kind of high octane. You know, you've got a momentum loading that's, you know, maybe on the order of twice something like the iShares MTUM, you know, MSCI based momentum fund. And, you know, I mentioned capital efficiency earlier, like that's very important to me. I'm value diehard. I want to hold mostly value. So if I want a little bit of momentum exposure, I want it to be very high strung so that a relatively small allocation can actually move the needle. Same thing with the managed futures CTA side. So I did dabble with some funds held on margin as an overlay in the past, but currently I'm working with a manager that provides an SMA where I can have my equity ETF allocation, and then they will trade futures on top of that, which is, you know, very capital efficient. It's a bit more tax efficient than, you know, having to use a margin loan to buy a product that's also holding a bunch of cash that you're going to have to pay tax on the cash collateral yield. So yeah, basically, you know, I can have 100% equity portfolio, and then I can take a margin loan for, say, 10 to 15% of the value of that portfolio and use that to collateralize some futures stacked on top. And the equivalent exposure of that futures would be, you know, on the order to like 100 to 125% of a typical managed futures fund. So if you view it that way, I'm like, you know, 2x levered. If you look at notional exposure, you know, it might be more like 4 or 5x. But, you know, that's just the nature of the internals of these managed futures funds that are holding a lot of assets long and short, quite a bit of leverage, kind of proportional to the volatility of everything.
Gotcha. So what are some of the managed futures vehicles they use? Or it sounds like this is happening independently, or are you owning like an ETF that does manage futures?
Yeah, so right now it's direct held futures, but yeah, in the past held a variety of funds. I think it's you know, there's an incredible suite of new products coming out. It's one of the areas that's kind of the fastest growing, at least that I've seen, obviously, because I'm very interested in it. But it's a lot of wonderful products out there. You know, I know you had Andrew Beer on your podcast. His DBMF, you know, has done incredibly well.
Yeah, it was a great conversation.
Yeah, so that's a very interesting fund, very simple, holds only like 10 contracts, and somehow has managed to replicate these managers with 60, 80, 100 plus assets. So that's pretty neat. You know, there's KMLM is one I often recommend. It's from a group called Mount Lucas that has an index going back to like 1988. It's relatively high volatility, which is something that I think is kind of confusing for a lot of people. You know, a lot of people are like, you know, why do I want more volatility? That means more downside. But in the CTA space, you know, these funds are so highly levered and so capital efficient that they can just hold a few more futures, get more exposure, and they're getting that at the lowest possible borrowing cost imaginable, you know, the very close to the risk-free rate. So the best example I like to use is AQR has two funds. They have QMHIX and AQMIX, and they are identical funds, except QMHIX is 15% vol, and AQMIX is 10% vol. And you can plug this into Portfolio Visualizer, and if you hold, you know, two-thirds QMHIX and one-third cash, and then, you know, compare that to 100% AQMIX, you get the same return. But if you look at the AUM, I don't have the, you know, exact numbers on my hand, but the lower vol fund is orders of magnitude more AUM than the higher vol fund, which to me is just completely irrational. Like, why not hold less of? You don't have to take the more aggressive exposure. You don't have to compare 5 or 10% allocation in one to a 5 or 10% allocation in the other. You got to vol adjust these things. And whether you just want to hold a little extra cash for a rainy day or put that money into, you know, another diversifying asset, you know, more equities, other alternatives, whatever it is, it's crazy to me that there's this natural desire to have a lower volatility fund rather than just manage that yourself by holding a bit less of it.
Gotcha. Yeah, that makes sense. I know in the past when you've talked to, right now it sounds like you're using levered, like direct leverage, like you're actually levering up a portfolio. In the past, I know that you've used, I think you've mentioned it, you talked about UPRO and TMF. Is that right? Have you ever used those products?
Absolutely. So are you familiar with the infamous hedge fundies excellent adventure thread from the Bogleheads forums?
No.
So I can't remember when this journey started. I kind of caught wind of it in 2019. And this is before I went 100% into factor investing. And, you know, for a few years, it was 100% value. But I kind of caught wind of this thread, you know, earlier on in my investing journey when I was still on the Bogleheads forum. And it was this guy that came out and he had, you know, all these plots. And he had worked out a back test of UPRO, which is a daily resetting 3X S&P 500 fund. And TMF, which is a daily resetting 3X 20-year treasury fund, I believe it is.
Is this that guy who levered up in the 2008 and then blew up?
No.
No, this is a different one? Okay, no.
Market Timmer, maybe?
Yeah, I don't know.
This is version two, because this guy's probably blown up a little. Realistically, gotcha. I believe at the beginning of the thread, he put $100,000 in, and I don't think that was entire portfolio or net worth. But yeah, so he took these, you know, 3X S&P, 3X 20-year treasury. And the original idea was a 40-60 split between equities and bonds, and then obviously 3x leverage on that, which was closer to risk parity, equal vol weight between the two. And this thread just grew, like, it became the largest. I think it still has the most posts of any thread on the Bogleheads forum, which is pretty ironic. You know, I don't know how Jack Bogle would feel about a 3x levered portfolio being the number one thread on his forum, but it just kind of captivated people. And as I'm sure you know, there's been a very low equity bond correlation, and, you know, bonds have had an incredible bull run since the 80s. So a bunch of us in another thread started trying to build a data set.
We're not going in a good direction, basically.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Recent performance has been rough. At the time, it was wonderful. So we started building the data set going back to 1955 with trying to get as many of the assumptions as we could for how these funds, what their borrowing costs would be on the swaps, and, you know, obviously getting the daily resetting leverage incorporated appropriately and whatnot. And obviously 1955 to 1982, I think, was where the previous data set had cut off, was a bit different picture. Still did pretty well in the full scheme of things. But after that came out, the kind of go-to portfolio became 55% UPRO, 45% TMF. So just giving equities a bit more weight, you know, kind of deviating from that risk parity approach. And this was kind of my first foray in. You know, I had my Roth IRA and I was just kind of still tinkering and learning about different things. You know, it was my first time thinking about holding uncorrelated assets and levering them up, you know, even if they were lower vol, to kind of get to your expected risk target. And it was a great learning opportunity and kind of played around with volatility weighting them based on recent vol and all kinds of things. But ultimately, in that thread, I became known as the EDV guy. So that, I don't know if you are familiar with EDV, but it's Vanguard's like 25-year strips ETF. So it's a very long duration treasury.
Yeah, it's like TLT, but amped up.
Exactly. But, you know, but still Vanguard, I think it's like 12 basis points, you know, well managed, well run. So basically what I did was I said, all right, this 55-45 UPRO TMF portfolio is neat. It's got fun performance, but obviously the daily resetting leverage is going to induce a volatility decay. TMF had a pretty spicy expense ratio, somewhere in the order of 1%. The leverage in general is still very high and poses some risk. So I found simulated data set of strips, basically EDVs, what EDV's price return would have been if they existed back then, and compared that to the TMF volatility, or ultimately the duration of, you know, 3x 20-year treasuries, and found the ratio of UPRO to EDV that would be the same ratio of equity vol to treasury vol of the 55-45 UPRO TMF. And that came out to 43% UPRO and 57% EDV. And I put my entire Roth IRA in that. It was not a large sum of money back then, but it was like a third of my portfolio, and rode that up for like a 44% gain, which, you know, at the time I felt like the world's greatest investor. And then meanwhile, you know, there's a tendency in the past for me to continue researching to dive into an investment quickly and then research it and, you know, potentially change my mind as I learn more. And kind of just studied the correlations, realized that the very low equity bond correlation of more recent years is kind of more of an outlier than the norm. And at the same time, this is when I was also really diving deep into value and kind of going for more of a surface level understanding to really having strong convictions, understanding the nuances between the various ways of approaching value, gaining conviction that even if it had relative underperformance, I was very comfortable with the absolute return profile of value. So I think we've probably talked about this before on Twitter, but like I always find the dichotomy of 2000 to 2009, small value does 10%, the market does zero. It's the greatest thing that's ever happened. 2010 to 2020, small cap value does 10%, the market does 14%. Everyone says value is dead. Over the full period, value crushes. It did a steady 10% CAGR every decade. Like, what's not to love? So I got out while the getting was good, and dumped all of that, you know, hedge fundy excellent adventure into value. To kind of the rest is history. I rode that out until I started adding the managed futures overlay. But yeah, I've always kind of felt the one thing that makes me feel a little bit better about my tinkering, and I'm much better now. I think I've satisfied my tinkering and kind of have a portfolio I'm happy with. But in many cases, every time I made a portfolio adjustment, I was selling high to buy low. I was adding more value. I was moving U.S. equities to international equities. So I at least give myself a little bit of comfort that when I did tinker in my past, it wasn't the stereotypical, oh, this isn't working anymore, I got to sell it and buy the new hot thing. It was actually the opposite. So hopefully I'm not making the same mistakes that the average investor does.
Gotcha. So for trend following in particular, what do you think is the cause of that? Do you think that's also a behavioral thing, just like value?
I do. There's interesting arguments, and Eric Crittenden, who manages the Blendex fund at Sandpoint, which is an interesting product, he is kind of one of the main proponents out there that has said he actually believes it's like a risk-based, you know, risk transfer from people that need to hedge, you know, predominantly in commodity markets. Price starts to go up, they need to hedge their exposure, and there's a little bit of a premium, you know, insurance premium that they're willing to pay you to hold that. I mean, if that's true, awesome. You know, like I said about value, as an engineer, I like a risk-based or an economic-based explanation. It makes me feel like it's not going to be arbitraged away. But ultimately, I really do think that it's a behavioral component, an underreaction to new news, or people just aren't willing to believe something until it's so obvious. And I mean, in our recent years, the bond trade has been the most compelling example. You know, rates have gone down towards zero. You know, finally rates start to tick up. And at every moment, you know, everyone's always like, all right, this is it. The 10 years at 1.5%, we got to go max long. All right, this is it. The 10 years at 2.5%, we got to go max long. It's obviously going to mean revert. And that force of people just, you know, trying to buy the dip and piling in, what allowed that bond trend to just continue for, I don't know, 2 years. CTAs were short bonds in scale and making a ton of money on that short. And, you know, if it wasn't for that natural, you know, tendency to be slow to adjust, you know, maybe rates should have had a step change and, you know, just shot from 50 bips to 5% in a matter of weeks. Fundamentals maybe justified that. But because people were so apprehensive to believe it, it just causes this long, prolonged trend. And it gives you enough time to, you know, receive that signal, get into the trend, and get out. If it doesn't work, systematic process, there's no emotions involved, If something moves against you, you'll hit your stop or, you know, cross your moving average, whatever your system is using, and you'll cut your losses. And also, like value, behaviorally, it's really hard to hold. I would say it's even, you know, harder than value in equities. I mean, at least long-only value, you've got this beta component. And beta is like a very left skew convergent strategy. You're going to have, if everything's working in the world, you're going to have these small wins every day. What do they say? The market takes the escalator up and the elevator down. And then something goes wrong. Assumptions are changed, you know, and something goes crazy, the market crashes and everyone kind of freaks out for a few months, however long it takes, and then it starts going up slowly again and you feel good most of the time. Trend, on the other side, is this very divergent strategy. You're basically taking all these small losses nonstop. You know, it's just bleeding for years and years and years. You're taking these small losses and then suddenly something goes crazy in the world. You know, expectations are not met. There's this big divergence. And you have this huge surge and this huge gain. Sometimes it's, you know, just a random time. Sometimes it happens during an equity crash, which obviously is, you know, the holy grail. If you can get something that will surge when equities are crashing, that's a wonderful portfolio complement. But either way, just standalone, it's incredibly hard to hold something that has more losing periods than winning periods, even if those winning periods are so strong. So, you know, similar to value, I believe that there's a big behavioral component there. Even if the smart money can see that this statistically has had a premium in the past, it's hard for them to put enough money in to arbitrage it away. You always think, oh, there's so much smart money, but a lot of that smart money is holding client money. And at the end of the day, even if you know that this strategy is going to outperform, you still have career risk if you expose your clients to it. They might leave you to go for the guy who's just got everything in triple lever 2Q. And it's just crushed it the last 5 years. So, yeah, I believe it's a really difficult strategy. Like value, it's a relatively low sharp strategy. And I actually view that as a good thing because I think that gives it kind of the staying power to keep working for the long term.
Very cool. And I also know that you're a believer in global investing. So the funds you own are diversified globally. So why do you like global investing as an approach?
Yeah, I mean, top level, it kind of goes back to my Vogelhut's roots of just buying the haystack. Like, I might want to tilt to certain types of equities, you know, within the regions, but I'm still a believer that there's nothing special about the U.S. And, you know, similarly to my affinity for value, just like I think that the U.S. is a unique opportunity for value, I also think international investing is in kind of a trough in relative valuations and has had a period of pain that may make the forward returns, you know, more compelling, but it's really not a tactical thing for me. Like, in general, I just believe in diversification. I also think that within the factor world, most of the money that's trying to exploit factors is within the U.S. market. So if there was a market that was going to get arbitraged away or have, you know, its premium eroded more so, I would believe that to take place in the U.S. market before it would take place abroad, where there's just a lot less dollars fighting for this premium. So yeah, I also, you know, as someone that's all in on factor funds and my equity exposure, I definitely believe there's a potential for the premiums to remain higher longer abroad. And, you know, obviously the data in the last, really since post-publication has proven that, but, you know, in recent years as well, the ex-US value premium has been much stronger.
Gotcha. Something that shocked me when I looked at it was the extent to which global ex-US outperformed from like 1970 to 1990, to the point where I think if you look at all of the data since 1970, that global ex-US and the US are basically on the same level. Like, it's just that since 1990, the US has dramatically outperformed. And then if you go back in time and you look at the 70s and the 80s, international did much better. And I always thought that was a pretty interesting dynamic.
Yeah, I can't remember the exact starting date. It might be 1970 as well, but Meb Faber tweets a lot about, has some great plots. And he actually suggests that all of the U.S. outperformance occurred post-2010. Basically, it was like neck and neck until 2010. And then we've just had this incredible, you know, U.S. recovery out of the financial crisis that the rest of the world just didn't get. You know, going back to what we were talking about, you know, relative valuations, you know, previously, like, you see the same thing in the data. Like, if you look at the starting case 10 for the different regions, it explains, you know, the next 10, 20 years pretty well. Is it tradable? I don't think so, but I think it just gives me confidence that the recent outperformance that has occurred is not entirely due to the U.S. just being a superior market. Have the U.S. fundamentals driven some of the outperformance? The data I've seen, AQR has a great piece called The Long Run is Lying to You, does indicate there's been some. but the vast majority of it has come from multiple expansion. And, you know, obviously multiples can't expand forever. Eventually, that has to lend itself to lower forward returns. And conversely, the lower multiples abroad should lend itself to higher forward returns. So, yeah, I find it very interesting. I'll be very intrigued to see, you know, what the typical FinTwit personality is pushing. You know, nowadays it's all, oh, I'm so diversified because I got SCHD or whatever, US dividends, VTI, and QQQ.
Yes.
But, you know, it'll be pretty funny if in 10 years it's like all in on IVL, baby, all in. So I don't know.
Maybe. I could definitely see that shifting. Like, the US, their political system is such a mess, blah, blah, blah. I'm sure they'll make up some kind of narrative to go along with the price. That's usually what happens.
Yep, it usually does follow. So yeah, it'll be fascinating to see. But yeah, either way, the main balance is, you know, costs, and the international funds have come down meaningfully. Tax differential is still, you know, the international funds, especially factor funds, do tend to have a higher dividend yield, which can be a little more painful. But I think that is also driven by the fact that they are meaningfully cheaper. So that might just be an indication of how much cheaper those markets are. And if you're going to, you know, benefit from that outperformance, you might have to pay a little bit more taxes in the meantime. So yeah, I just kind of have landed on a roughly 50-50 split between US and international, kind of just hedging my bets. I know the US market cap is a bit higher than 50%, but I've always found that market cap can be prone to, you know, bubbles and anti-bubbles. So obviously if the US is overvalued, that means its market cap is higher than it, you know, should be, then it's kind of natural equilibrium. So I've often used the research affiliates. They have some like fundamental weight global indexes where they'll take adjusted sales, book value, dividends, all these different fundamentals that aren't tied to price, and use them to figure out the weight of individual stocks. And they'll do this, you know, within US stocks or international stocks as well, which kind of gives you just a value and size tilt. But they also have a global index. And I think that global index is weighted closer to like 45% US, 17% EM, and the rest in developed, you know, ex-US. So it's a bit closer to what I have. And I think that is a, you know, maybe a bit more robust portfolio, because if you just go with pure market cap, you're going to hold the maximum US exposure when the US, you know, is at the maximum relative performance, or, you know, if it was at a bubble peak and vice versa. So I think there's some benefit to kind of having a bit more balanced approach that isn't following Soros's line too much and chasing into the bubble.
Gotcha. If you were setting out to construct a very simple portfolio of, say, like 3 ETFs, what would something like that look like?
Yeah. I mean, going along the lines, like obviously I like my factor exposure, a little, you know, global diversification, but I also like some trend. And, you know, trend is amazing when it's overlaid on a portfolio, you know, managed futures trend, but absolute returns are typically going to be less than equity. So for someone that doesn't want to directly manage their own leveraged portfolio, there's a lot of really exciting. Corey Hofstein and the gang at Resolve, they kind of coined the term return stacks. You know, there's portable alpha, there's all these different phrases, but building products that include core beta and then adding an alt. So they have a fund, RSST, that I find really interesting. It basically gives you, for $1 into the fund, you get $1 into S&P 500 exposure plus $1 into a managed futures replicator. You know, I mentioned Eric's Standpoint. He has a fund that's like 50% equities plus managed futures overlay. There's a few other ones. So yeah, I mean, you could do an equal split of something like, you know, RSST to give you 100% equities plus the 100% trend. And then maybe you could honestly just put the rest in, like, Avantis has an incredible fund of funds called AVGV, which is, it basically just holds all of their value funds globally. So you get one single ticker, you get global value diversification. It's actually more tax efficient than like Vanguard's VT fund, which doesn't hold a US and international ETF separately. It combines them, which precludes US investors from getting the foreign tax credit. ABGB, actually, you would still get that foreign tax credit on the international holdings. So yeah, I think you could honestly get away with just two tickers, you know, ABGV and RSST. It's going to give you a little US overweight, which most investors want, and some managed futures stacked on top, and, you know, just weight the relative difference between your conviction for value versus your conviction for managed futures. And yeah, I mean, I think something like that would be infinitely more diversified and higher returning, expected returning, than, you know, the typical all in on US large cap, or even better than a market cap global equity fund.
Very cool. Before we wrap up, do you have anything you wanted to add for the audience?
I guess the last thing I would say, one thing that I've really found is the key to sticking with your asset allocation is to pick some funds that you just really have conviction in or some strategies you have conviction in. I think there's so many unique products coming out these days, in particular in the alternative markets, that it's so easy to say, oh man, I really need to add this long vol fund, or I really need to add this style premia fund. And if those strategies speak to you, fantastic. But for me, I found value, momentum, trend really, you know, sits well with me. And I also have that big eyes when a new product comes out and I'm like, ooh, well, you know, what's this, you know, long vol strat? And, you know, I'll plug it into the back test and I'm like, you know, the benefit is marginal. I don't really understand it. It's more of a black box to me. Is it just going to cause problems down the road? Probably. So I think people should strive to have a diversified portfolio, ideally hold more than just global equities, you know, add some factors, maybe add some alts, but try and find that comfortable balance and don't go overkill, because it's very easy to just constantly be compelled by that newest strategy or that newest product. And, you know, once you kind of hit that sweet spot where you have conviction in it and you're reasonably diversified, it's best to just let that ride.
Very cool. Well, what are the best ways to learn about you, to reach you, to read your content?
Yeah, I mean, HML Compounder on Twitter is definitely the best way. Twitter has been an incredible resource. I joined it just kind of wanting a news aggregator to get like research papers. And I've met all these incredible, you know, like-minded investors like yourself. You know, I've connected with and spoken with people that I kind of put on my Mount Rushmore of investors, which blows my mind. These people are willing to correspond with me or hop on a phone call with me or whatnot. So it's just been an amazing resource. If you're not on Twitter, highly recommend you get on there. And if you are, say hi.
Awesome. Well, thank you for your time today.
Really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun.
Thank you for listening to today's podcast. For more information, please go to securityanalysis.org. Subscribers to the website get early ad-free access to podcast episodes in addition to weekly in-depth profiles of companies.